to life.
Part 5.
The moment of farewell is one of the hardest moments for anyone. Whether it is saying farewell to your family, your home, your homeland, and the most significant of all, saying farewell to life. But for a fighter, the hardest one is to say farewell to their arms. Palestinian fighter and leader Yasser Arafat was a man who experienced each and every one of these farewells throughout his life. Now, he had turned into a comatose in a hospital bed in France before he experienced those farewells. His first painful farewell took place 50 years ago when he witnessed a series of events that changed his course of life. It was springtime in the small village of Deir Yassin. The inhabitants of the village did not want any war with the intruders. But sometime later, the United Nations divided Palestine into two Arab and Jewish sectors and caused rifts instead of solving the differences.
The resolution of the Duck Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
After the UN resolution, the Palestinians possessed only 45% of their country in two disjointed segments, namely the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. The rest of the 55% was given to the minority Jews with a 500,000 population. By recognizing Israel as a so-called state, a war started. Now the Jews could expel the Palestinians out of their homes and replace them with the newly arrived Jewish immigrants. It meant that Israel has started a proxy war against Arafat. At the moment when Arafat needed foreign help more than ever, things did not go well. In Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser's advisor and deputy succeeded him, but he took a different path.
Let us agree that whatever happens between us, we should solve it together through, talks rather than going to war.
Egypt could retake the Sinai Desert after 20 years of Israeli occupation and then avoid conflict with Israel for the sake of establishing peace. But it wasn't the end of the story. American representatives enter Beirut to establish a ceasefire once again. The U.S. won Arafat's confidence and, more importantly, convinced him to take all Fatah forces out of Lebanon. In return, Arafat asked for the security of Palestinian refugee camps. In the end, the Falangists also reached their goal. After 7 years of war and bloodshed, their leader was to become the president of Lebanon. Fatah forces said farewell to Lebanon in several stages.
We must do all that we can to close the gap between Israel and the Arab states, and between Israelis and Palestinians. There can be no substitute for diplomacy. The time has come to put an end to Arab-Israeli conflict.
The Knesset is now debating a no-confidence motion against the government raised by six opposition parties.
Israel was under pressure to either accept the peace proposal or hand the cabinet to someone who could solve the issue through negotiations. On the other hand, when the massacre at Sabra and Shatila took place, Arafat found himself at a dead end, as if everything was over. Such words could still be heard. The words were rarely heard, even during the war. There was increasing pressure to declare Al-Quds as the capital of Israel.
The United States of America has an absolute right to place its embassy in a capital city, any capital city. Clearly, Jerusalem is the capital of Israel.
The Islamic Jihad dissuaded Israel from pursuing peace efforts by conducting two operations. A few days later, Arafat and Rabin were invited to an economic conference in Jordan. In his speech, Arafat asked the U.S. not to make any decisions that would hurt the peace process. But at the same time, another strange event unraveled in Malta.
So far, we have invested much in blood, much time, and much money. We invested in war. Today and from here on, we are committed to invest in peace.
On Rabin's orders, the leader of the Islamic Jihad was assassinated.
Yasser Arafat was back in Gaza after the Middle East Economic Summit in Amman. It was the first time the PLO chairman has broken his silence on the killing. While condemning the gunning down of Shikaki, he refused to speculate on who might be responsible for the Islamic Jihad leader's death.
We are continuing investigation for this serious and this serious crime, and which we cannot accept at all.
However, in order to get results from the negotiations, Arafat had to give up some of his dreams. He abandons the goal of making all of Al-Quds the capital of Palestine, and instead recognize the western half of the city as Israeli soil. On the other hand, Rabin wanted to keep Arafat away from Gaza and its Islamic movements, so he agreed to hand over the eastern half of Al-Quds to Arafat in the near future. Arafat was preparing to return to Al-Quds. He relocated his headquarters from Gaza to Ramallah, the closest city to Al-Quds. He is one step away from Al-Quds and is waiting for return. A week later, before the new round of negotiations began, Rabin showed up for a speech at a rally among his supporters. Rabin said things that could keep Arafat hopeful for the next round of talks. But at the end of that rally, the assailant was a 25-year-old Israeli student who was immediately arrested.
I am very sad and very shocked for this awful and terrible crime against one of the brave leaders of Israel and the peacemakers.
A few hours passed without any news about Rabin's condition. Arafat was more worried than anyone else.
Tonight, at 11:10 p.m., as an outcome of murderous criminal assassination attempt. The Prime Minister of Israel and the Minister of Defense, Mr. Yitzhak Rabin, passed away.
Arafat was clearly worried about the future of the path he had taken. Now, he was left alone with Rabin's hollow promises. It seemed there were other issues behind the friendship with Rabin.
According to what they had promised, in the first year, $690 million. Now we are in November. Do you know how much we had received?
That's what I was going to ask you.
Less than 40.
Arafat was still waiting to leave Ramallah and get the permission to enter Al-Quds. The feudal meetings caused uproar among the people. Now, most of the demonstrations were against Arafat and not in his support. As time passes, the people lose hope. The lives of Palestinians after peace were not much different than what it was like before.
We should get our freedom, we should get our identity, we should get our passport, we should get our country. We are not in animal zoo. They are crazy. They want just peace.
70% of Palestinians were still unemployed. The figure was the worst, yet the only thing that Palestinians could do was to work as day laborers for the Israelis. Of course, if they can get past the Israeli checkpoints.
He received a day around 120 Israeli shekels. But the same unskilled workers who is Israelis, he cannot accept to work the same job, but not less 400 to 500 shekels.
Israeli forces had not left the areas under the governance of Arafat's administration and had even increased their patrols. They had access to water and electricity for only a few hours a day because of the frequent blackouts and disruptions. People did not feel that Arafat would care about the liberation of Palestine and improvement of their lives. Because of all these issues, there weren't many people who weren't interested in the opening ceremony of the Gaza airport in the presence of Bill Clinton.
I would like to welcome President Clinton and Mrs. Clinton. It's an honor to have you here, and I would like to give you the honor to cut the ribbon to announce the inauguration and the opening of Gaza International Airport.
Arafat did not have much time to restore hope to the Palestinian people. 2 years had already passed from the promised five-year deadline. During that period, Israel has changed three administrations, from Shimon Peres, who was Yitzhak Rabin's closest friend, to Benjamin Netanyahu, who was the greatest opponent of the peace process, and now Ehud Barak, Rabin's Minister of Military Affairs. But the negotiations remained unsuccessful, and Arafat got nothing but hackneyed promises. But while Arafat had failed to reach the least of his goals, a group in Lebanon was materializing his dreams. The Lebanese Hezbollah movement that was formed in the early 80s with the goal of fighting Israel had now become a force to be reckoned with and had made Israel retreat during this period. Finally, on May 20th, 2000, they forced Israel to withdraw from Lebanon after 20 years of occupation and liberated occupied Lebanese territories. Now, Israel also needed a final deal with Arafat. Clinton was spending his last days in the White House and wanted to leave a final legacy. So he sought to assure everyone the story was going to have a happy ending. The negotiations were held behind closed doors.
After 14 days of intensive negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians, I have concluded with regret that they will not be able to reach an agreement at this time.
Chairman Arafat, I think, he will be going back to his Palestinian people also, explaining all the things that happened.
But the Palestinians who were present in the meetings had a different opinion.
Israel wanted to continue its occupation of some of Palestinian territories.
That the Israelis and Americans did not listen to Arafat's requests and instead asked him to hand over Palestine to Israel and recognize Al-Quds as Israel's capital in return for a $30 million bribe, and threatened him that if he disagreed, he'll have to face his past nightmare. On his way back home from the U.S., Arafat was wondering what he achieved with peace and if the path was even worth it. Arafat was no longer the man he was a few days ago. After 7 years, he took up arms. And when people heard about that, they gave him a hero's welcome. Ariel Sharon entered the Al-Aqsa Mosque along with 600 Israeli troops and closed the doors of the mosque to all Palestinians. And 3,000 forces were also stationed throughout Al-Quds, and martial law was imposed on all Palestinian neighborhoods. Arafat did not want to lose the opportunity again, so immediately reestablished the Fatah military organization. It was going to step up cooperation with the movements in Gaza. Palestine witnessed the most intense conflict of its history. The situation was deteriorating by the moment. With the start of the Second Intifada, many Israelis decided to leave Israel. And Israel was not in a good economic situation. Investors were more willing than others to flee. Sharon tried to stop the flames of the Intifada. Leaders of the Hamas movement were assassinated one after the other. Sharon even went further. The Israeli tanks were only a few meters away from Arafat's office, and his administration's other buildings were occupied. But Sharon's efforts were futile. Arafat lived under house arrest for 2 years, but this time around, he did not lay down his arms. His goal was to keep the Intifada alive, and on the other side, Israel was worried that assassinating Arafat would fan the flames of the Intifada. So it was forced to back off so it could take out Arafat in a way no one would notice. After several months, Arafat got severely ill. It took him a while to get permission to go to Paris for treatment. Arafat never saw November 11th, 2004. Maybe the question on Arafat's mind at the end of his life was, what would have happened if no one had ever said farewell to their arms?
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asle zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Alavi Tehrani. Please stay tuned.
اگر کسی بخواد وارد وادی محبت هم بشود باید این گونه باشد.
Loving Ahlul Bayt means to be faithful towards Islamic rulings and to have their love in your heart and soul. Loving Ahlul Bayt has two important aspects. From one side, loving them without doing our obligatory deeds has no value. From the other side, our obligations have no value if we do not have the true love for Ahlul Bayt in our heart.
اگر کسی اهل سید الشهدا هست ولی اخلاق نداره، اهل سید الشهدا هست ولی دین درست حسابی نداره.
For instance, if someone loves Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, but he or she doesn't have good morality or behavior, such a person is resembled to those who miss reaching the ark of salvation of Imam al-Hussein and his guidance. There are a few people who claim to be the follower of Ahlul Bayt. However, their deeds are not like those of Ahlul Bayt at all. A true follower of Ahlul Bayt must act like them too.
Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Alavi Tehrani. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
An unstable wholesale energy market coupled with Britain's reliance on energy imports makes it inevitable that the British public's energy bills will rise from current levels. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newsletter The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Energy bills in the United Kingdom are expected to rise by 5% from January after analysts predicted that the government's price gap could increase to about £1,930 a year for a typical gas and electricity bill. According to Martin Young, an analyst at the investment firm Investec, British households can expect a tough winter ahead after a jump in gas market prices that is likely to raise the cap on what suppliers can charge for energy by an average of £100 a year. Martin Young said his financial estimate for the energy price cap that would be used to determine most household energy bills between January and March of next year would climb to an average of £1,928, up from £1,834 now. Cornwall Insight, a leading energy consultancy firm, has estimated that the price cap for the first quarter of next year could rise slightly higher to an average of £1,931 for the typical British household. The forecasts are based on the wholesale market prices for gas and electricity, which have climbed in recent weeks after the start of the Israeli aggression against Gaza. Craig Lowry, a principal consultant at Cornwall Insight, said, "An unstable wholesale energy market, coupled with Britain's reliance on energy imports, makes it inevitable that energy bills will rise from their current levels. This leaves British households facing yet another winter with bills hundreds of pounds higher than pre-pandemic levels, and affordable fixed deals few and far between." The concern over rising energy costs has been compounded by the increase in standing charges, which suppliers add to energy bills as a flat daily fee, often likened to a line rental for a phone, to cover the cost of connecting households to their energy supplier. On Thursday, 16th of November, the energy regulator Ofgem opened the review of standing charges, which for some households will double over the past 2 years. From 1st of October, the amount these charges add to a typical dual fuel bill will rise to above £300 a year, a figure that some argue unfairly penalises low-income households. Tim Jarvis, the Director for Markets at Ofgem, said, "We know that standing charges have provoked a huge amount of debate in recent months, and with wider cost of living pressures, meaning customers will continue to struggle with their energy bills, now is the right time to look at this again." Tim Jarvis added, "The standing charge is covered by the price cap, which puts a ceiling on what suppliers can set it. Suppliers are also under no obligation to have a standing charge and can charge less than what is set out in the price cap." Tim Jarvis added, "However, it's a complex issue, and while an upfront set fee to cover a supplier's fixed cost works for some, it doesn't work for others. Equally, spreading the cost differently might help some, but our previous analysis has found it can also penalise some really vulnerable households." The website This Is Money has also covered the same story and tells us more. Researchers say 3 in 5 over 60s with a household income of £20,000 or less have cut back on their heating or powering their homes in order to make ends meet. Age UK said as the cold weather kicks in, 8.9 million people in Britain, or 54% of the population of over 60s, are worried about being able to pay their energy bills this winter. Not all government financial assistance is open to every pensioner, and eligibility criteria often apply, notably for pension credit. One unnamed 72-year-old man, ineligible for pension credit, told Age UK, "I don't know how I'm going to manage this winter. I've applied for pension credit but got turned down, and because of this, I'm not eligible for the cost of living payouts this year." He added, "The only extra money I received is a £200 discretionary payment from the council. I do get housing benefit, but it still leaves me £200 short because my rent has increased. Meanwhile, a 67-year-old woman told Age UK, I'm constantly economizing. I wear extra clothes but do find my hands go tingly as I'm cold. I don't drive and cannot travel easily due to ill health, and now I can't afford taxis to get around or socialize. I try to shop around but cannot keep up with price changes in different shops. Money decisions make everything more stressful. A 79-year-old man said, all of this year's state pension rise plus my savings is simply disappearing because of the huge range of price rises and cost of gas and electricity going up, council tax going up, home insurance and the absolutely disgraceful continuing rise in all foods of every kind. He added, absolutely everything has increased in price. Millions of pensioners are simply existing or living in fear about the future. The average home currently pays energy bills of £1,834 a year, alongside sky-high costs for food, fuel and other essentials. The charity Age UK said 7.3 million people, equating to 44% of those over the age of 60, have already cut back on social and leisure activities amid higher bills for basics like energy and food. Age UK said about 2.6 million people over the age of 60 have cut back on their telephone, internet and water usage in a bid to keep costs down. Caroline Abrahams, charity director at Age UK, said, there is rising concern about how some older people will cope with the temperature dips and they need to turn up the heat. Our new statistics reflect what we are also hearing on the Age UK advice line. Many on low and modest incomes are already fretting about how they'll keep their heads above water when the winter bills come rolling in. Caroline Abrahams added, as ever, our biggest worry is that they will be so frightened of being unable to pay that they'll turn their heating down too low through the colder months, if they run it at all, jeopardising their own health. Caroline Abrahams added, after two tough years of this vicious cost of living crisis, some older people say they're unsure how they get through a third winter, having run down their savings and made all the economies that they can. Unfortunately, the experts say that energy prices are set to go up in January, dip in April, and remain at high levels for the rest of 2024.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish
the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the medical issues based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, Sheikh Javed, assalamu alaikum to you, and welcome to the studio again.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Let me ask you this question at the beginning of this episode. For the sake of medical training and gaining a skill and experience, is there any difference between examining the genitals and or other parts of the bodies of the non-mahram persons, first of all? And what is the ruling in the matter of male doctors practicing midwifery and other childbirth complications in remote villages? Where no female doctor is available, noting that one of such complications is life-threatening, bleeding after labor, for example. Stopping such bleeding needs proper training and experience during the course of study in schools and medicines.
Well, of course, as you rightly mentioned, it is a skill that must be learned. Midwifery is an essential skill. And I think in a Muslim society, it is necessary for Muslim ladies to acquire this skill in order to be able to examine women and to deal with their problems without them having to go to male doctors to expose themselves to their private parts to male doctors in the case of necessity. Now, as you the focal point in the question is whether it is permissible or not in the case of necessity to turn to a male doctor. Of course, insofar as necessity is concerned, there is no difference between the ruling of examining the genitals in other parts of the human body, because the universal criterion is the need for the training and is studying medicine to save the human life.
Mm.
That is the main thing, and it's very much important. It's always essential that we have to take this criterion into consideration, that when it comes to saving human's life, it is necessary. And it makes no difference whether that life is the life of a woman or a man. So, of course, in such cases, one should always suffice with the necessary cases. For example, one should not go, one should not touch a woman unless it's necessary. Mm. One should not look at a woman's body unless it's necessary. So one should always suffice with the necessity. And when the necessity is removed, the male doctor has no right to go on touching or seeing the woman's body.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much, Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RAB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Shah Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to medical issues according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Well, Shah Javid, in most cases, where examining the genitals, whether by a male or a female doctor, is called for the Sharia standards, are seldom upheld by the student or the teacher, I mean, medical student or the doctor and professor at the university, such as examination through the mirror, you know?
Yes.
Well, since we have no alternative but to follow them in order to gain experience in diagnosing the illnesses, how should we go about this?
Well, there is no harm in studying medicine and training in it, even by carrying out examinations which are haram in themselves, provided that it is essential for training in medicine and acquiring experience in treating the patients. And in addition to that, the student must be confident that the ability to save human life in the future depends on knowledge and the skill gained in this way. So if he is not confident, if he is not, sure that this will, this ability will depend on, acquiring this skill will, is necessary because it's going to save human's life. If he is not sure, then he will not be allowed, or it's not permissible for him to touch and see the body of a person from the opposite gender, especially the genital area, which is very much haram to see unnecessarily. So one must be confident that he would be in a situation where, for example, whereby the sick are going to consult him to seek his advice, and that he would be responsible to save their lives in the future. Mm-hmm. If this is the case, of course, he is absolutely allowed to acquire skill and knowledge in that field, even if he or she may be required to see the genital parts of the person.
Mm-hmm. I see. Somehow a relevant question would be, or similar to the scenario I just asked, is it permissible to look at the pictures of non-Muslims usually found in the books of medicine? Noting that such pictures are of semi-naked or even utterly naked men and women in the books.
You know, it depends on the intention of the person looking at these pictures. You know, if the intention is not questionable, if it's not within, if a person does not look at these pictures with lustful intention, and with the intention of seeking pleasure, and there is no fear of falling into a sin, so in this case, there is no objection to seeing those pictures. Of course, a male student or a female student looking at those pictures wants to learn something. And if that is the case, and he has, and he or she has no questionable intents, so it is permissible. Otherwise, it is not.
Mm-hmm. Again, a similar question, Sheikh. You know, just to reiterate the point in terms of the medical scenarios, especially when we are looking at or we hear stories and read articles. From the medical students, for example, and their training and internship in the hospitals, just to gain their medical, knowledge and skills.
Yes.
In the course of their study, medical students watch films and look at pictures showing the genitals for learning purposes. Is it permissible? And what is the view on looking at the private parts of the opposite sex?
Well, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, there is no objection to watching such films and looking at such pictures in themselves, provided that it is done without the intention of getting sexual pleasure, and one is confident that he will not end up falling into a sin, and he is confident that he will not commit a haram act. So if it does not involve committing a haram act, then there is no problem.
Mm-hmm.
What is haram actually is looking at the private parts or touching the body of the opposite sex without there being an urgent need. So, and of course, when it comes to looking at pictures or watching films of others' private parts, again, this is it is. It's permissible, provided that there is a sensible reason, a rational purpose behind it, and that is to acquire knowledge, to gain a skill, and to become expert in order for him to be able to save a human, a man's or a woman's life in the future.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, and thank you, my dear listeners, for joining the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to RIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.